Hello, I am Chuck Rosina. On Monday evening, February 25th, 2013, the Economics Department of Northeastern University in Boston held a seminar called The Future of Global Capitalism. I had the pleasure of recording this event. They invited three speakers from various fields. Each speaker talked for about 30 minutes on their views and took questions from the audience. The speakers were Rachel Menard, a Northeastern alumni and CEO of a Wall Street venture capital firm that she founded, Menard Capital, Bill Cheney, CEO of Manulife Asset Management, and Professor Noam Chomsky. While the other two speakers talked of rising global economic powers like China or using impact investing for social change, Professor Chomsky chose to take on the issue of capitalism itself and talked of capitalism versus reality. Here's what Professor Chomsky had to say.
I'd like to talk about something which is not quite capitalism, but what we might call really existing capitalism. By that I mean what really exists and what's called capitalism, whether it should be or not. The prime and most important example is the United States, so I'll focus on that for obvious reasons. The term capitalism is used to cover a great variety of possibilities. For example, it's applied to the U.S. system. What is the U.S. system? Well, for one thing, it has a very substantial and massive element of state intervention in the economy in many respects. The most dramatic and striking is that that's how the high-tech economy is developed. So, for example, take the IT revolution. Almost all of it developed primarily in the state sector for decades. Your computers, the internet, satellites, all of it, either through direct under in government labs or university labs under funding from government institutions by procurement, which is a major way to advance technology, huge way. And in fact, it was really, if you look at it, it's about 30 years primarily in the state sector, the period of the greatest creativity, innovation, and so on, before it was handed over to what's called private enterprise, largely government subsidized, to develop it further for the commercial market. That was the role of Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, and so on. But the work had already been done, the basic work. If you look at biology-based industries, it's about the same. And furthermore, if you go back, say, to the 19th century, the development of the famous American mass production system, which amazed the world, mostly government armories and so on. And it's pretty natural. That's the place where costs are borne by the public. And why should private power want to pay for things if the public will do it for them? So it's a very characteristic aspect of really existing capitalism, and there are many others. So one that everybody knows right now and should have known about before is the government insurance policy for major financial institutions called Too Big to Fail, which encourages risky transactions, maximizes risk because it's pretty safe. If a risky transaction makes a lot of profit, if it collapses, the nanny state comes and bails you out, and you go on with one of the directors of the Bank of England recently called a doom cycle, where each one worse than the last, beginning in the early 80s with the so-called neoliberal period, and each one worse than the last. We're now moving on to the next one. So that's called capitalism, and I'll use the word, but I don't know what it has to do with capitalism. A limited market. There is a limited market element, although even that's pretty limited, because the advanced sectors of the society, the major ones, are highly monopolized. And that's been increasing very rapidly in recent years. So since about mid-90s, the share of profits of the 200 largest enterprises have rapidly risen. And of course, all of that undermines market competition in some well-known ways. Now, there's a related concept related to capitalism, that's democracy. So I'd also like to talk about really existing democracy. Democracy is a contested term, like capitalism, but at least there's one condition that it ought to meet, a minimal condition, that public opinion plays some kind of a role in determining policy. If it doesn't have that property, it's not democracy. But if you look at really existing democracy, that's not true. So in this topic that happens to be very well studied in professional political science, where study attitudes, which is easy to investigate in the United States, very heavily polled society. We know a lot about what people think. And policy, of course, you can look at policy. And the results are quite interesting. It turns out that if at the, say, the roughly the bottom 70% of the wealth income scale, there's almost no influence on policy. The political leaders just not even paying any attention to them. As you move up the scale, you get a little more influence. When you get to the very top, basically, they get what they want. So the system is essentially a plutocracy. It's called democracy, and we can call it that if we like. The public, incidentally, is quite well aware of this. They may not know the details that you find in technical articles, but kind of aware of how it works. A poll just a couple of days ago, which is pretty typical, asked people whether they thought that Congress represented the people. The number was 11%, which is a little higher than it's been in the past, so maybe it's improving. There have been a lot of debates over the years, you know, interesting philosophical debates about whether capitalism and democracy are even compatible. Okay, you can debate it, but I think we can say that the question has been answered for really existing capitalist democracy. They're not compatible. We see it right in front of us. I also want to ask a question about really existing capitalist democracy, namely, can civilization survive it? I think that question is going to be answered probably within your lifetimes, maybe not very far ahead, and very likely the answer will be negative. And I think it's worth paying a little attention, a lot of attention to that. I'll try to give the reasons. We might ask, incidentally, whether a functioning democracy might alleviate this danger. I think there's some reason to think so. So let's keep now to the most critical, immediate problem that civilization faces, that the human species faces. There's something new in the history of the species: environmental catastrophe. Not a joke, very serious, probably imminent. Here, policies and attitudes diverge radically, as is very often the case in really existing capitalist democracy. Actually, if you want details, the nature of the gap is explored in several papers in the current issue of the Journal of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. And what they show is that, looking at policy, of 110 relevant countries, 109 have a national policy to deal with environmental problems. One doesn't. The typical case of the most advanced case of really existing capitalist democracy, us. 118 countries have set targets for renewable energies. One hasn't. The same. Now, it's not public opinion that drives policy off the international spectrum. Exactly the opposite. Public opinion happens to be pretty close to the international norm. Could give you the quotes of the details if you want, but it's easily demonstrated. The fact that the public is influenced by science is deeply troubling to those who dominate the economy and the political system. One current illustration of their concern is an interesting program called the Environmental Literacy Improvement Act. It's being proposed to legislatures right now by ALEC, That's the American Legislative Exchange Council, as you may know. It's a corporate-funded lobby that designs legislation for states to serve the needs of the corporate sector and extreme wealth. Well, the ALEC Act mandates what they call balanced teaching of climate science in K-12 classrooms. Balanced teaching is a code phrase. It means teaching climate change denial to balance mainstream science. It's analogous to what's called a balanced teaching advocated by creationists to enable creation science to be taught alongside what they call evolution science, in other words, science. It's all dressed up, of course, in nice rhetoric about teaching critical thinking and so on, but it's not hard to think up, critical thinking is a good idea, but it's not hard to think up ways to teach critical thinking that are not designed to advance corporate profits and that do not threaten the existence of the species. These are based on conceptions that there's a controversy, that they say there's a controversy, major controversy, over whether humans are changing the weather. Now, if you look at the media, there is indeed a controversy, and it's interesting to see the way it lines up. On one side, there's the overwhelming majority of scientists, every one of the world's major national academies of science, virtually everything, virtually in the science journals, professional science journals, the international IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, they all agree that it's happening, that there's a major human component, that the situation is serious, possibly dire, and that very soon, probably within decades, we might reach a tipping point where it becomes irreversible. And then after that, it get nonlinear processes, starts to escalate, and it's out of control. It's rather rare to find a consensus of that kind on any complex scientific issue, but it is in this case. Well, that's one side of the debate in the media. The other side of the debate is the skeptics. That actually includes a few respected sciences, a handful of quite respected scientists, who caution that a lot is unknown, which is true. And the fact that a lot is unknown means it could be not as bad as the consensus thinks, or it could be a lot worse than consensus thinks. That's what it means to say a lot is unknown. Now, there's something omitted from this contrived debate. That's a very large number of skeptics, quite a large number among mainstream climate scientists, happens to include the climate change group at MIT, for example. And they're skeptics because they regard the consensus as much too conservative. And they've repeatedly been proven correct over the recent years. I could give you examples. But they're not even part of the debate, although they're very prominent in the scientific literature. Well, this ALEC campaign, others like it, are part of a huge campaign by corporate lobbies to try to sow doubt that human activities are having a major impact on global warming with possibly ominous implications. Actually, the campaign was pretty openly announced, publicly announced by Chamber of Commerce, the main business lobby, American Petroleum Institute, others. However, it's worth bearing in mind that the efforts of ALEC and the famous Koch brothers, who are commonly brought up, that's just a small fraction of what's underway. The initiatives are pretty massive, and they're concealed in all sorts of arcane ways. Sometimes it's partially revealed. There was just a study that came out that found, I'll quote it, that conservative billionaires used a secretive funding route to channel nearly $120 million to more than 100 groups casting doubt about the science behind climate change, helping to build a vast network of think tanks and activist groups working to a single purpose, to redefine climate change from normal scientific fact to a highly polarizing wedge issue for hardcore conservatives. Conservatives, another term that I don't think ought to be used. I think they're radicals. This propaganda campaign, primarily in the United States, has had some effect on public opinion, so it appears. U.S. public opinion is a little more skeptical than the global norm. But the effect is not significant enough to satisfy those who, the ones who Adam Smith called the masters of mankind. That's presumably why their major sectors of the corporate world are launching their attack on the educational system to try to counter the dangerous tendency of the public to pay attention to science. You may remember that a couple of weeks ago at the Republican National Committee's winter meeting, Governor Bobby Jindal of Louisiana warned the leadership, as he put it, "We must stop being the stupid party. We must stop insulting the intelligence of voters." Now, ALEC and its corporate backers, in contrast, want this to be the stupid nation for very principled reasons, and they're working hard on it. One of the dark money organizations that's of billionaires funding climate change denial is called Donors Trust. It's also, it turns out, to be a major contributor to the current efforts to deny voting rights to blacks. It's coming up in this one aspect. That's coming up in the Supreme Court now. And that makes good sense. Blacks tend to be Democrats. And if that wasn't bad enough, they tend to be social Democrats, supporting welfare state measures. And what's worse, it's likely that they're escaping training in critical thinking and may have a dangerous tendency to pay attention to the sciences. Actually, the major science journals regularly give a sense of how surreal all of this is. I'll give a couple of current examples. I'll keep to Science, the major science weekly. A couple of weeks ago, it had three news items side by side. One reported that 2012 was the hottest year on record in the United States. That's continuing a long trend. The second reported a study by the U.S. Global Climate Change Research Program, which provided new evidence of rapid climate change as a result of human activities. Discussed severe impacts. The third news item reported the new appointments to chair the committees on science policy chosen at the House of Representatives. In the House of Representatives, a minority of voters elected a substantial minority of Republicans. That's thanks to one of the ways of shredding the democratic system that's been carried out under really existing capitalist democracy. All three of the new chairs deny that humans contribute to climate change. Two of them deny that it's even taking place. One is a longtime advocate for the fossil fuel industry. Actually, the same issue of the journal has a detailed technical article with new evidence that the irreversible tipping point may be ominously close. Go back to right now, the current issue of Science underscores the need to ensure that we must be the stupid nation. The article reports new evidence that even very slightly warmer temperatures, less than what is anticipated, is very likely to start melting permafrost. That in turn, that does set off one of these nonlinear processes. It triggers the release of very high amounts of greenhouse gas trapped in ice. So you can see that it's best to keep to balanced education, at least if we can look our grandchildren in the face. With really existing capitalist democracy, it's extremely important that we become the stupid nation, not misled by science and rationality in the interests of the short-term gains of the masters. These commitments also are deeply rooted in the market fundamentalist doctrines that are preached within really existing capitalist democracy. I stress preached because They're not observed. They're observed in a highly selective manner so as to sustain a very powerful state that serves wealth and power. But just keeping the official doctrines, they do suffer from a number of familiar what are called market inefficiencies in the technical literature. Among the market inefficiencies is one crucial one, namely the fact that the effects on others don't enter into market transactions, one of the externalities. The consequences of these externalities can be quite substantial. In fact, the current financial crisis is an example. What's not taken into account when, say, Goldman Sachs makes a transaction or something is what's called systemic risk, the risk that the whole system will collapse if it crashes. And there's something similar in the case of environmental catastrophe. It's far more serious, though. Here, the externality that's ignored is the fate of the species. And in this case, there's nowhere to run, cap in hand, to get bailed out after you've created a massive crisis. We're living with that right now. Well, these consequences have deep roots in really existing capitalist democracy and in its the doctrines that it professes, doesn't live up to them, but that it professes, like market fundamentalism. And that's one reason, not the only one, where I think it's pretty unlikely that civilization will survive a really existing capitalist democracy without pretty severe blows. Well, final comment. I suppose that a future historian, if there is one, and that's not obvious, would look back at a rather curious spectacle that's taking place right now. For the first time in human history, humans are facing a very significant prospect of severe calamity as a result of actions that they're quite consciously undertaking. And there is a range of reactions. At one extreme, there are those who are trying to act to prevent possible catastrophe. At the other extreme, there are major efforts underway to deny what's happening and to bring on the catastrophe as far as possible. Leading the effort to bring on the catastrophe is the richest and most powerful country in the world, in world history, with incomparable advantages. And the most prominent example of a really existing capitalist democracy. Leading the effort to preserve conditions in which our immediate descendants might have a decent life are the so-called primitive societies, First Nations, Aboriginal, Indigenous, whatever they're called. The countries that have large and influential indigenous populations are well in the lead in the effort to preserve the planet. And the countries that have driven indigenous populations to extermination or marginalization, they're the ones who are in the lead in trying to bring the crisis as close as possible. So, for example, take Ecuador, which has quite a large indigenous population, has oil. Right now it's seeking aid from the rich countries to help them keep the oil underground where it ought to be. Let's go to the opposite end, the U.S. and Canada, the richest, most powerful countries. Here we're enthusiastically seeking to burn fossil fuels, including the extremely dangerous Canadian tar sands, and to do so as quickly and fully as possible, while at the same time leaders are hailing the wonders of a largely meaningless century of energy independence, without a side glance at what the world would look like in 100 years or even less if we continue this extravagant commitment to self-destruction. And in fact, the observation generalizes. Throughout the world, indigenous societies are struggling to protect what they call often the rights of nature, while the civilized and sophisticated, us, are scoffing at this silliness. That's exactly the opposite of what rationality would predict. unless we mean the skewed form of rationality that passes through the distorting filters of really existing capitalist democracy. Thanks.
After his talk, Professor Chomsky took a couple of questions from the audience.